Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. I titled this series of conversations with young people, The Love of Learning and the Desire for God. I met each person in this series while teaching at Newman Theological College in Edmonton from 2020, during the pandemic, through the fall of 2023. Newman had just introduced a new degree and moved its curriculum into a Great Books and Socratic Dialogue model. I am joined by André Boudreau in this podcast. André grew up in Calgary and attended the Junior Seminary of Christ the King for grades 9 through 12. This junior seminary is part of Westminster Abbey in Mission, British Columbia. The Abbey is a Benedictine foundation formed in 1939 from the Abbey Mount Angel in Oregon. André entered St. Joseph's Seminary under the auspices of the Bishop of Calgary, along with his discernment toward the priesthood and the formation in the seminary community. He's completing his degree with studies at Newman. Welcome to our conversation. André, I met you in class at Newman Theological College here several years ago. 3 years ago? Something like that.
Yeah, sounds right.
I think. And you are in the seminary. And my understanding is that Newman introduced this new program, a new degree in Catholic studies, using the Great Books approach. And when I was called and asked if I might teach a little bit in it, I was absolutely astonished to hear about this program. When I studied in Chicago back in the 60s, I had benefited from having a number of professors who had studied at the University of Chicago when Robert Maynard Hutchins became the president. And if I recall correctly, it was Hutchins' father that started the Great Books program at St. John's University, which is one of the first ones in America. And so several of my professors who had been, as young men, had been in the Second World War, and then came back and on the GI Bill could go to university. They were a little bit older, and they'd seen a lot of deaths. So it was a really remarkable moment in the late 40s and 50s at Chicago. And Hutchins had introduced a core curriculum where all the students, whether they were studying mathematics or business or chemistry or philosophy, would read their way through the great books, the kind of classics of that have been central to the development of Western civilization. They would also read some great works associated with other civilizations as well, but it was primarily becoming familiar, having a conversation with Plato and Aristotle, Euripides and Aeschylus, all the way through to Freud and Uncle Karl Marx.
Yeah.
So it was, and this influenced my professors deeply, so we always read, we read very good books. And so a lot of my professors had been influenced by this, and it was also the paperback revolution, so access to books was relatively cheap, and so we read a lot and a lot of primary works, and I just treasure that approach. I think it's so different than what's happened in universities more recently. I would like to know just a bit about your early formation and how that was shaped, and then coming to Newman. And then I'd like to chat with you a little bit about how the education you were getting there. Now you're in the seminary, but this program in Catholic Studies was started, if I understand it correctly, at least in part, because it had become apparent to a number of people, perhaps even bishops in the church, that in preparation for seminary, as is the Catholic pattern from the Middle Ages, you first read philosophy, and then only once you get grounded in the philosophical tradition do you move into the study of theology. I still think it's a fabulous approach. But you're from Calgary, just south of Edmonton here. And you're, how old are you?
I'm 23.
23.
Yeah.
So, you grew up in Calgary.
Yep.
And if I understand it correctly, you grew up in a Catholic home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, yeah, I grew up in the middle of the city of Calgary. For most of my life, yeah, just, I was homeschooled actually up until about grade nine, where I went to. I ended up going to a boarding school or minor seminary for those who would know what that is. It's an older term, in BC. But yeah, I grew up in a Catholic family and there is, with eight siblings. So like a big, big Catholic family and I'm right in the middle. So I wasn't one of the kind of guinea pigs, and I'm also not one of the spoiled ones at the end. So it was kind of a good mix, I think. Very Catholic family that, and my parents sort of had found their faith within a few years of their marriage.
What do you mean by that?
They both were born and raised Catholic, but it's Catholic in the loose term, where you would sometimes go to Mass, maybe once every month or so, and you'd get married in the church because that's what you do. And everybody's Catholic in your little town, because my dad comes from a small town off the coast of Cape Breton. Almadam is its name. It's beautiful, but you can see in the name already it's the
right.
Our Lady's Isle.
Uh-huh.
And so the whole culture there is just very Catholic, but Catholic culturally, not necessarily internally. So that was sort of what they grew up with. So when my parents first got married, they moved to Ottawa first. The faith wasn't really something that was part of their vision for their family until both of them had a sort of deep conversion in the 90s towards the faith. So it was very, very, to them, it totally altered the course of the way that they were planning on raising their family. My mom had plans to be a lawyer. She was in law school and she was doing quite well. My dad's an engineer, so they were planning on being sort of your power couple with a few kids. And so,
do you know about that conversion as you described it?
Yes, yeah.
Do you know where that comes from?
Yeah, it
what the impetus was for that?
It starts with my mom. She took a job as a choir director because she's very musically gifted.
Like her son.
Thank you. So there's a position that opened up that paid $10 a mass to play the piano at a nearby parish and sort of lead their choir a little bit. My parents were quite poor because they were just coming out of university, and that's what you are when you're starting out. And so my mom took this because this was a huge opportunity. It was to make $10 a week would make a huge difference. And so she started going to Mass every week and hanging around with these Jesus freaks, as my dad would call them. And to be fair, some of these characters were a little true to their title, but
so these are Jesus freaks in the context of the Catholic Church.
Yes.
Which is different than the Jesus freaks that I knew in the 60s.
Though I'm sure there would be some overlap, but
that
yeah
would be
so she just started really her own faith journey started deepening, and then my dad started getting concerned that she was spending too much time with these Jesus fellas, and so he started going to their brunches that they would have after Sunday Mass, just to see what it was about. And he sort of didn't really fit in with the group too well. But he didn't. He would, as a true East Coaster, he had no idea about this. So at one point in the conversation, he blurted out, "If I ever had a time machine, I would go back to the time of Jesus to see if he really existed."
Ah.
Which is a funny thing to say after coming after a brunch after Mass. And it sparked a conversation that changed the course of, I think, my whole family. My mom's friends, they're the godparents of a lot of my older siblings. They immediately turned to him and said, "Oh, of course Jesus is real. What are you talking about?" And one fellow was just like, "Jesus is so real that his mother, the Virgin Mary, is appearing to people all the time right now in Medjugorje."
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And this guy said, "I'm going to drop off a book at your door tomorrow, and I want you to read it." And my dad's like, "Who the hell?" Like, okay, sure, buddy. Like, sure enough, the fella did actually. He dropped off this book about Medjugorje, and my dad...
And Medjugorje is a place in... It's in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Yeah.
I've actually driven close by it with a bunch of Muslims on one occasion. And it's a pilgrimage site.
Yeah.
Because it's a site of a remarkable apparition.
Yeah, and it's sort of under evaluation right now by the Catholic Church on whether or not these visions are authentic and all these different things. There's a lot of things that goes on in Medjugorje, so they're... But it's a very beautiful pilgrimage site at the very least. And it's been it has a huge place in the hearts of many of the faithful for just that reason, at the minimum.
Yeah.
And so, my dad just brought this book inside with no intentions of reading it and put it on the side table. And then that night he opened it, and he wanted to, because he had nothing better to do. My parents were poor, so they weren't going to have any other means of entertainment, really, aside from crib. He opened the book to a random page, and it just said, "Jesus is real, and he loves you." And from then on, like, he was just inspired with, like, talk about, it's a very Protestant thing to say, but, like, he had the gift of faith, and it never wavered. That's when his faith really entered in his life. And so I think that's a very real experience. And for him, he just never wavering. So like throughout my entire life, I just remembered my dad with this unwavering faith, which apparently he didn't have before I came around. It's kind of hard for me to conceptualize. Now, he's not the most pious fella. He's still an East Coaster.
Oh, good. Glad to hear that.
Yeah. But this faith is just unwavering, and very simple in some ways, but in that way it's deeper than you might expect. So my parents just decided to raise their family Catholic, and my mom got very involved with the parish, and we would go to Mass on Sundays, and we would altar serve as young boys, and so it was a really big part of our lives, was our faith growing up, because of this powerful experience that my parents had.
And the rhythms of the liturgy.
Yeah. Yeah, and my mom really got into, like, trying this liturgical understanding. Because she's not the type to just do something and just kind of get it over with. If she's going to do something, she wants to do it well. And so she... started studying the liturgy a bit because she got involved with her church and continued teaching music and choir directing and all these different things for many years. Decades. So she started reading some of the things that the church had to say about the liturgy. And it just, it really, really transformed our entire family life as well. Again, it was like a deeper conversion, right?
So this would have been in the wake of Vatican II.
Yes, yeah, so...
So there was a... in the wake of Vatican, Second Vatican Council, there was an awful lot of discussion and writing, thinking about the liturgy, because at the Vatican Council, they had brought in a new liturgy.
Yeah.
I like to say, from the perspective of the Christian East, they brought in a new liturgy without... going back to the Tridentine liturgy, And they certainly didn't go back to Vatican I. They went back to the apostolic period.
Yeah.
And they sort of rethought the liturgy because in my, well, my sense is that the Tridentine liturgy, which was shaped in the face of the Reformation, my sense is it tended to give too much to the Reformation and defined itself a little too much in terms of the Reformation to try and provide a kind of corrective or a counter to that. But that's a whole other story, and I'm not really in any position to speak about it.
Yeah.
But it does mean that in the wake of the Vatican Council, which was finished in 65, a lot of Catholics, I mean, it's so interesting. In some ways, the Catholic Church at that time began to thin down a bit, but it also became much more intense.
Mm-hmm.
And this, as you flagged with your parents, there was a movement, at least my impression is there was a movement in a lot of Catholics from being cultural Catholics to now being intentional Catholics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very much the case, I would say. And that's still, it's still being played out. I think it's going to be played out for a long time. On the way that that's, because, yeah, the liturgical changes came around in the 70s. But since then, there still have been more changes that, like, the church has altered a little bit of things, sometimes translations, right? Because previously, the liturgy was all in Latin. So suddenly, you have this opening up of the possibility of using the vernacular in Sacrosanctum Concilium of the Vatican Council. And so you have a whole bunch of different things coming out. So you have to come up with translations that you would make official for all these different languages that would be praying in this different, this rite. So there's since been quite a few changes. And so one of the changes that was up and coming for my mom was in 2011, where they made a lot of changes towards the words of the congregation's part within the Mass. So they didn't really change it.
Like the responses.
Where they tried to make them a little bit more in union with the Tridentine form. And make the translations a little bit more precise rather than loose. And so that sparked a sort of investigation on her part because she didn't, at first when you like, you get in, like all these new changes, it's never comfortable. So she started reading about the reasons behind these different translations and she started reading Sacrosanctum Concilium and she started reading the general instructions for the Roman Missal, which is sort of our rubrics that we have. And all these different things that you would never expect the laity to read before the Vatican Council, like ever. My mom really got into reading these different things. So liturgy became a huge part of my life growing up. She started playing CDs about the liturgy. So I'd be hearing about the liturgy throughout. And she started talking about the importance of certain texts and the importance of, being reverent and the importance of using certain propers that have been used throughout the history of the church and all these different things that you probably wouldn't see in your typical tiny little country parish choir director kind of thing. So she really got into this.
So she became one of your first liturgical teachers.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it led us on a sort of path of discovery. Eventually, some of her changes were not well received, I think, because she started making adjustments to the music that she was selecting for Mass and things like that to try and make sure that it was a little less, sort of jumpy and a little bit more reverent and focused on the readings and what was going on in the Mass. There is a little less space for certain hymns and songs and things like that. And she tried to make space and introduce chant into a parish.
Oh, wow.
Which was, like, I had never even heard about. I had heard of chant in my, like, in sort of a context of Tibetan monks. That's about it.
or Salems.
Or you know, yeah.
Benedictine monks.
Later on, I would encounter them. But yeah, like I was, to me, I didn't know chant was something that was Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
Until this journey. So She eventually started adding, we started using chant mass parts and things like that, and chanting certain propers that were set for the day by Salem. I didn't know this at the time, but it is by Salem.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't really, it was too much change too quickly, which I see now. So the parish didn't receive it as well as my mom had hoped. And they ended up asking her to revert back, and she just said, I can't in good conscience. I know what I've been asked to do by the church, and I just can't not do that. And so we decided to go to a different parish and look for a home. And that's a really difficult experience, actually, as a child, to look for a new home, a spiritual home. And we found one in the Anglican Ordinariate. There is a parish down in Calgary that had become Catholic.
And that's what Anglican Ordinariate means.
Yes.
It refers to mm-hmm. those Anglican churches that, mm-hmm. When you were a young person, that decided that they were going to leave the Anglican Communion, mm-hmm. and they talked with the papacy, and they actually enter
mm-hmm.
the Catholic Church,
yeah.
and they're allowed to bring with them some of the sensibilities of the Anglican liturgy.
And so, we got immersed into this beautiful
mm-hmm.
High Anglican liturgy, basically, had become Catholic, Catholicized, mm-hmm. or whatever.
Yeah.
If you, and these priests were ordained, and they had families. So that was a really unique...
Yeah.
My parish priest growing up was a married man who had, he was a very good pastor, but he had unbelievably good liturgical sensibilities.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that drove him a little bit to his conversion. And he brought the parish with him. He was really a shepherd to them. So they really wanted to follow him wherever he went.
Who was that?
Father Lee Kenyon.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And so we went to this ordinariate parish for many years. And my mom ended up getting involved with the music there as well because they needed some help. And she learned the Anglican tradition and just fell in love because what she was looking for and what she had been reading in all these different documents in an odd way existed in this Anglican hymnal and tradition.
Right. And one of the reasons for it,
yeah.
I think, is that the Anglican, you had Cramer and you had King James.
Mm.
So the Anglican, the Book of Common Prayer
that
Cramer has given us, and the King James translation of the Bible are really the pinnacle of English.
Mm.
You know, there's a charming thing that happened in England. It would have been in the 70s when... the Church of England also decided it would come up with what they called the Book of Alternative Services
mm-hmm.
to counter, to provide an alternative to Cramer, to the Book of Common Prayer. And this, actually schismed parts of the Anglican Church because people took it so seriously. But just a charming thing that occurred. I followed that a little bit. Because I was interested in how this was playing out. And at the time, the leading journal on poetry in England was called the PN Review. So there's a special edition of the PN Review that was published. I have a copy of it, faded pages now. It was edited by David Martin, who a fine Anglican, but also... one of the few sociologists that I've read benefited from. And it has, it must have 20 or 30 short essays in it. And it's published under the title, The Crisis for Cramer and King James. And they gather together, it's like a who's who of English letters. Great actors, philosophers, historians, some people from the church, and they're looking at what is happening here to English culture. And many of them begin by saying, I want to assure everybody, I remain an atheist. But what the hell are the bishops doing with our church? Changing the Book of Common Prayer and the King James Version of the Bible. It is utterly charming to read these but it has a lot to do with how you've described your mother here. It has an awful lot to do with reverence. Mm. And what is the place of reverence in the liturgy? And how does the liturgy cultivate within us a reverential attitude to life?
Yeah.
So you went to the Anglican Ordinariate how old would you have been when you first started going there?
I would have been about 9 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
And we went until I left for minor seminary. Mm-hmm. So it was my parish in terms of my active maturing memory. That was my parish and my mm-hmm. pastor. And I did start serving there too. And learning from this priest, all these different liturgical sense of it, the way of he said the liturgy was just unbelievable. It was so reverent, so attentive to what was going on, that I it really attracted me to think about being a priest. Where I really first started thinking about being a priest. And through this rich liturgical life that had really formed my heart towards this. And there was many people involved. There was a few priests before, the transition wasn't as easy as one might think, right? So it takes time to get ordained a priest in the Catholic tradition, right? So as soon as this community became Catholic, their pastor, Father Lee Kenyon, wasn't ordained. He wasn't ordained for still another year. So there is another Catholic priest from the Diocese of Calgary who is assigned to help out this Anglican Ordinariate parish.
Wow, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
That in itself is an interesting...
Yeah.
Interesting how the hierarchy of the church chose to address this and shepherd it.
Yeah. And it was really beautiful. This priest, it turned out, this is nothing but the providence of God. That priest is the priest who baptized me.
Mm, that Catholic priest?
Yeah, who was assigned to this parish. Mm-hmm.
What was his name?
Father Michael Story. He's still alive. Mm-hmm. His health is deterring, so we can pray for him. But he was assigned to this. And the way that he went, he was the most humble I've ever seen any man ever do anything. Because he didn't know this rite or this use of the Roman rite at all. And so he literally was being led by the hand through certain parts of the liturgy by Father Kenyon at the time.
Boy, that is interesting. And then you go to the Benedictine Monastery and Mission for high school.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. So I went from grade 9 to 12 it's a monastery out in Mission, B.C., Westminster Abbey is after New Westminster, B.C., not Westminster Abbey in England. It's spelled slightly differently. It's called Seminary of Christ the King. And so it's a minor seminary. So it does have the objective of forming men to be able to enter what they would say major seminary or call, for us, it would just be natural seminary.
On the pathway to priesthood.
Yeah, so there is a priesthood... that is part of the formation, is geared towards priesthood.
But it's important to note here, I think, that, at least I've certainly seen this, that within the Catholic Communion, the matter of formation is taken very seriously. So this begins minor seminary, it begins early. But there's no assumption that this is going to lead to priesthood.
Yes.
That is another matter, but you need to prepare, and that preparation is very serious and begins when you're in high school.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, that's very accurate. In fact, from this minor seminary, very few of the boys end up becoming priests in the end. Some of them enter seminary, but not always finish. So the it's normally one from a year at the most. That you would get.
And how many were in the class?
About 9 for my class. Huh. Yeah.
So it's intimate.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's about 36 students for the whole school during my time. There's a few less now. And so they have 8 to 12 is normally the grades that they span. So they go from grade 8 to all the way to grade 12. And it's a very small, some classes are very small and some are larger. So mine was a larger class at 9 and there are some classes that were as small as 4.
And it's residential.
And yes, it's residential. So you're, it's probably one of the last residential schools in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I think about it. But yeah, so it's very interesting because unlike your average public school or private school, your cohort isn't just your grade. Your cohort actually is the whole community, seminary community. So you have grade 12s interacting with grade 8s and grade 9s and grade 10s and grade 11s. And in that way, there is a brotherhood that actually takes place that's very, very important. For that dynamic. So entering in as a grade 9, I had to very much learn my place as the youngest brother, where I'm not the youngest in my family, so I had to learn that. That was a very difficult transition for me, but it was very good. It's very good to learn how to be the youngest brother.
Mm-hmm. And how was at this junior seminary, could you characterize the attention given to intellectual formation and to spiritual formation and how those dance together, if they did?
Yeah. Oh, they certainly. So they would structure your entire day around the Liturgy of the Hours. So from you'd be praying the Psalms throughout the day. So you'd say morning prayer, and you would say midday prayer, and you would say evening prayer. So that's about 3 of your offices. And so depending on which tradition and which way you're looking at it, there can be anywhere from 5 to 7 in your complete office. And so for the monks, it was 7. So we would participate in 3 of those 7.
With the monks?
Sometimes with the monks and sometimes on our own. So we're in our own little seminary community. And the monks but on feast days and solemnities and Sundays, we would go and participate with the monks. And so it was a sort of privilege. And we get to pray the Liturgy of the Hours with them. And out in Westminster Abbey, they really they had this monk who's now passed away, who designed this beautiful, basically sort of psalter for them. That's a combination of a 1-week psalter and a 3-week psalter. So they go through the Psalms relatively quickly, but you get to know them really fast. And so, like, I have a lot of the Psalms from there memorized. And so it just that, again, was a huge part of their formation, was that. And then they would also offer all of your normal high school courses.
So just let's come back. Let's linger with the Psalms for a minute. I've said for years, if there was one thing I could do for the church, and by that I mean any church, would be to restore the Psalms as their prayer book. Mm. It, of course, is the prayer book of the Jewish community. It was Jesus Christ's prayer book.
Yeah.
And within that monastic tradition, and out at Westminster, you would pray all of the Psalms. How often?
So, yeah, I should make a little caveat. We wouldn't pray all of them. We would pray most of them. There's a few that we wouldn't pray.
So the cycle, explicitly. But the cycle of moving through the Book of Psalms takes place, I think, in, if my memory serves me, and I'm sure you know, in the medieval period, the Psalms they prayed through the Psalter about every month or something like that.
Yeah, so in the Rule of St. Benedict, he has this wild line, which is one of those ones where you read some of these church fathers and you go, man, like, these guys must have been intense. he says, a holy man prays the Psalms every day.
Yes, right, yeah.
So you will pray it every week.
Every week.
And so traditionally, Benedictines would pray the whole Psalter every week.
Yeah.
So what the Westminster Abbey has a slightly adapted version, where they pray most of the Psalms weekly. And by most, I mean a very small majority. And then they would pray some of the Psalms every 3 weeks. So midday prayer, and for them, they called it vigils, not night prayer, because it was much longer than what we would associate with night prayer in the breviary set that's common in the Roman church right now, was on a 3 week cycle. And that was literally just singing the Psalms straight through. That was essentially the whole liturgy of the hour, where you'd go from one Psalm to the next and you just keep going. And so you cover a lot of ground in those hours.
And they're sung.
And they, even if they're sung at a very low kind of recto tono, which mm-hmm. is like a same note chant pace.
Can you just illustrate that with a few lines?
Oh Lord, you search me and you know me. You know my resting and my rising. All my ways lie open to you. That particular, that would be Psalm 139, which wouldn't be sung that way. But that's just the one that comes to mind.
Yeah.
But yeah, you have one steady note, and you sort of have these inflections. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that you're actually you pray with your heart as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It follows a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it actually matches quite well onto the Jesus prayer in the Eastern tradition. Anyway, so that was sort of my spiritual formation, was deeply enriched by the Psalms throughout those 4 years of my life that I deeply appreciate. And in that way, it taught you that your life was a preparation for the liturgy. That was one thing that the monks sort of taught me. And so going back to this liturgical formation that I received in my youth, it was built even more so by the Benedictines, because one monk once said to me, I asked him what he was doing, because he was reading out loud, in the middle of, outside, in the middle of nowhere, in the woods. I was walking in the woods, I found this monk reading out loud.
Beautiful woods there.
They are.
I've walked that even recently.
Yeah.
It is just gorgeous.
It's very special. And I asked, brother, what are you doing? He says, I'm doing what I'm always doing.
Mm.
I'm preparing for the liturgy.
Mm.
And that really sunk in.
So that's a,
yeah,
that's such an interesting phrase.
Yeah.
Life is to prepare for the liturgy. Walk around it a little bit.
Yeah. It was remarkable, because he was a very young monk. That's one thing I realized is just, age isn't necessarily the marker of wisdom for some of these monks. Some of the young monks there were unbelievably insightful, despite the fact that they never really studied, and they hardly graduated high school, because some of them were not necessarily academically gifted.
But they were steeped in the liturgy.
They were steeped, exactly.
When you say life is for the liturgy, does that also imply that the liturgy is for life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
That's the other side of the coin.
Yeah, I would definitely think that that's what he was getting at. It was this attitude of we're always constantly preparing to put our hearts on the altar of the Lord, but also to receive as well, right? That's what's so beautiful about the liturgy, is that it's not just it's not just an offering and a sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
It's also a communion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a mutual sharing between the community who share with each other, but also with God.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the monk, that becomes your life, right? Because you live in that community that prepares itself to offer itself in communion continually, but also to receive communion, which is a sort of a way that Catholics describe the Eucharist. When we receive it, we just say communion.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this ebb and flow between life and the liturgy. And that I will never forget that, I hope. That's the hope of my life, that I won't forget that. And yeah, this deeply struck me. And I realized that that was my life too, was this preparation for the liturgy. And there's a cosmic understanding that you can expand that even to, is where in a large way, heaven is just one heavenly communion.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, your life is a preparation for the liturgy, because the liturgy is heaven. It's heaven on earth.
Yeah. And the presence is here.
And it's here. It's here and now. Already, but not yet. Right? It's that beautiful principle. So it's the...
also must have involved you in some regular discipline of communion or of confession.
Yes, yeah.
So that would be a part of the formation as well.
Yes, yeah, weekly, often.
Weekly confession.
Yeah, we would have rosary. It was actually a really beautiful practice. I've never seen it anywhere else. I think that we would have rosary, and throughout the rosary, there would be confessions available. So there would always be some people praying the rosary, but we would take turns, and it would change from week to week who got to go first, which grade, and you'd do it by grade. And some grades could go to confession while we're praying the rosary. And I think the idea was that you're praying the rosary for your brothers.
Yeah.
And which is really, that's a really beautiful thing that when you're younger, you just do it because that's what you're doing. But these things permeate your heart. And that's, talk about education. That's the, I think largely, I don't want to get too far ahead, but what Newman's doing is, is that permeation through necessarily our concrete initial understanding into sometimes what we only receive from reflection. So it's a meaning that needs to be unpacked.
And lived into.
Yeah, exactly.
Lived into. And then lived out of.
Yeah. So these monks taught me quite, I would say, I don't regret a single second I spent with them. It was hard. They were brutal. They were strict. They're Benedictines. They need to be that way. They gave me so much. And they really inspired me to go to seminary. And their formation has been the reason I've been able to stay at seminary in a lot of ways.
The intellectual formation during those high school years, how was that shaped? And particularly, I suppose, what did they do with philosophy and theology in that formation at those younger years?
Yeah, they don't try to push too much. They're very careful with one, because they have to be an official high school underneath the jurisdiction of
the state
government of British Columbia. So
they fulfill those requirements.
Yes. So we would take anywhere between 10 and 13 courses at a time.
For the year.
Yeah, for the year. This was their way of meeting both. So it was tough, but some of these courses were lighter, where it would be like phys ed, where it's like you show up and you do what you're told, and that's the course. Other courses would be heavier, like Latin. So we did study Latin, and we would study French, and we would study English, and we would have religion. And that would change depending on your year. So in grade 9, religion was more focused around the catechism. In grade 10, it was focused on church history, which I thought was actually quite prudent. And then after you got an understanding for church history, in grade 11, you got scriptures so that you could really read how the church has been interpreting the scriptures. And then finally, in grade 12, we did morality.
Oh.
Only at the very end. Which is very interesting, because often we start the other way, where we start with the moral codes of conduct, and then we finally get, maybe if we're lucky, to scripture at the end, which is a mistake in my opinion. But that was sort of the structure that they had for teaching religion and theology. And then every night after our vespers, we would have a little bit of time before we would go to the supper, where the rector of the minor seminary, so at the time it was Father Peter Nygren, would go and speak to us. And he would speak for 10 minutes, and it could be on anything basically that he was reading, but he was a philosopher by discipline. So he often just talked to us about Aristotle's ethics.
And you'd do this before supper?
Before supper.
After Vespers.
After Vespers. So, like, and suppers there were, like, you wouldn't be talking, so you'd be listening to reading. So this would be a sort of interim between a time of prayer and a time of intellectual formation, where Father Peter would come up and he would address different things, right? So sometimes he would address being like, okay, I noticed that this is happening in the community, what's up? And so he would just talk about that or whatever. And he's like, I think that you guys need to stop. Like, I heard that you had a really rowdy hockey game today. What's that about? I heard that some people lost their temper and there's a fight that broke out. What's this about? So sometimes it would be a question that he would ask us, and then we would have to answer a little bit. And then other times he would just take something from the ethics. Or he also loved Don Bosco, St. John, Don Bosco, because he saw himself as very much put into that role. So he was a very powerful intercessor for him. So we read the life of St. Dominic Savio as well. And we read a lot of the sayings and prophecies and writings of Don Bosco, who is not your typical saint that you necessarily would study in depth. But
no, he was, say a little bit about him.
St. Don Bosco
was part of a religious community that was primarily concerned with children, wasn't he?
Yes, yeah, exactly. I think he actually founded it, if I'm not mistaken. So he had this deep heart for... it was during a time in Italy where there was a lot of street urchins, and he had a deep heart for these young men, because he knew that the trajectory that they were on, they would either end up dead very soon, or they just would never become much, because they wouldn't be able to. They were stunted in their growth, because they didn't have families to lean on, and they were left to thieving to survive. So he started schools for these troubled boys, and he taught them, and he fathered them, and many of them became saints. There's three that were canonized before he even died. So because they died as some of these young men were really not healthy, because they had contracted whatever tuberculosis or whatever. Bronchitis and things like that, and these diseases at that time were often fatal to these. So a lot of them would die younger, with a great holiness. And so one of these young boys was Dominic Savio, and so he died very young from illness. And so Saint Don Bosco wrote his life.
He wrote the life of his child.
Yeah. Wow. And it's The Life of St. Dominic Savio by Don Bosco. And so it's quite a beautiful, and you read it, about this young boy who tries to aim at purity, and that's his life. And so that was sort of what, purity in the way that he prayed, purity in the way that he interacted with his brothers, and purity everywhere. It was beautiful. Like, it was really quite beautiful. He rather die than sin. That was one. Death before sin, that was a huge part of our formation, was these talks that Father Peter would give us, so I learned Aristotle's ethics, and so we learned about the different kinds of friendships and the different ways that the human heart's all directed to happiness, but that was the only introduction to strict philosophy that I got.
Was in those talks. Pretty good way to get him.
It was really. I didn't realize it at the time, but later on, for Newman, I was writing my papers on Aristotle's ethics, I realized I knew this stuff like the back of my hand. It had been ingrained into me throughout these years. That's sort of a background.
That's beautiful. Many of the early philosophers, of course, were peripatetic. You learn on the way. You learn when you're walking.
Yeah.
That's gorgeous. How did you decide to come to Newman? How does that work?
Yeah. So, for me, I discerned that I should go to seminary at the end of my time in Minor Seminary. It was pretty clear.
The end of grade 12.
Yeah. I wanted to, like, a large part of me, even now as a seminarian, still wants to get married and have a family and all these things. But interestingly enough, the Lord had made it very clear to me that he was calling me to discern a call to the priesthood and celibacy, and discern them each in kind as distinct things, but still in union. Mm. And so I said, okay, I'll entertain this. See, despite the fact that I really wanted to kind of get into the world and all these different things. But the monks had pulled me aside and they said, no, you should really consider going to seminary. And I had had a number of experiences that made me realize the thing that I wanted to do with my life was walk with people. Mm. Very closely and in very intimate relationships. And at first I thought that I should be a psychologist, because that's what you do if you want to talk. But then the Lord made me realize, no, you don't really want to be a psychologist. You want to walk with them spiritually. You want to see their hearts.
Their neurosis.
And
not as a professional.
Not exactly. I mean,
psychology is kind of interesting that way.
Yeah. It's a really difficult. Yeah. That's a difficult line for a psychologist to walk. Many psychologists I know talk about it a lot, actually, how difficult it is that their clients are taxed in a certain way to come and see them. So there's a huge gift in the priesthood to not have that burden it's necessary. You have to support yourself and your family. But in the priesthood, it's separate in a lot of ways. You can offer your time freely, which is really a huge gift.
So when you say you realized you wanted to walk with people, you walk around that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. While I was in grade 12, something odd happened to me a lot. Whereas a lot of the younger guys, because I was one of the older brothers, would come and ask me for a lot of help. And at first it was like school. I was like, okay, like I can help you with your assignments or whatever. And then it started to get a little bit more deeper. Hmm. After I would help them with their assignments, they would say, how do you deal with purity?
Mm-hmm.
By that they mean chastity.
Yeah.
And this started happening to me a lot, multiple times a day, kind of thing, where I'd have these moments. My bishop has told me he calls them moments of celibacy.
Moments of
celibacy.
Celibacy.
That's his. Where you have this generative experience, where other people, for whatever reason, through no explicit empirical data, go to you with the struggles of their heart, especially in chastity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a lot of these moments of celibacy in that grade 12 year.
Mm.
And at first it made me super uncomfortable. I went to the monks and I said, like, I can't handle this. Like, this is crazy. And they'd say, no, just be calm.
Mm-hmm.
Just listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to solve their problem.
Mm-hmm.
You just need to walk with them.
Mm.
And so through helping some of my brother seminarian, like minor seminarians,
mm-hmm.
And walking with them in their struggle with purity and all these different things. Often it was purity and pornography and these different things. And normally we didn't have any access to that at minor seminary because there was no internet. But it was when they went home. So they would always be terrified of going home. And that would be a symptom of normally that you would see. And walking with them. And so sometimes it was about purity. Sometimes it was about struggling with other brothers. And sometimes it was about prayer. And so it became this thing that I would walk with a lot of these young men. And at the time, they weren't necessarily men in the eyes of the government, but I could really see their heart and what it would be one day be capable of. And it was really an experience like no other. And so it transformed me drastically. And I realized that that's really what I wanted to do with my life, was walk with people in that capacity. And that desire has not wavered at all. And so I decided to go to seminary, and part of seminary is Newman. So the
You don't just enroll, you don't just apply, do you? I mean, you must have had a conversation with a bishop.
Oh, yes. Yeah, so I had, to get into seminary for my diocese, I'm part of the Diocese of Calgary. It's a long process.
And your bishop was Bishop Henry?
Bishop McGrattan. I'm one of the first that he accepted, I think I'm the second seminarian.
I see.
Maybe a little more than that. But I'm one of the early ones. Because Bishop McGrattan now has been Bishop of the Diocese of Calgary since 2017. So
time flies when you're my age.
I really loved the, I went through this application process with the Vocations Director of Calgary. I met with a couple of other priests as well. And so you have to tell them why you want to be a priest, and you walk through all these different things. And it's a pretty intense screening process. It actually took a year. So I took a year off after grade 12, where I worked as an arborist in the city of Edmonton, but applying for the Diocese of Calgary. Had many interviews, so I'd go down to Calgary for interviews regularly. Some with priests, some lay people, and then one with a psychologist for an intensive psychological examination, which is about a 6-hour examination, where they he determines whether or not he thinks that you have the psychological ability to complete seminary. Which is actually a scary process. And the cohort of men who are discerning priesthood shrinked after that quite a bit. There was a few people who were told, no, I think that you need to take some time and work on some things. There's signs of certain struggles and mental illness and things like that that you need to work through. So it was a stressful one for me, but it worked out in the end, and I ended up being accepted to seminary in 2020. So I went for the fall, that fall. And then the first year of seminary is a year of prayer. So they called it a propedeutic year. And so throughout the whole year,
what does propedeutic translate as?
I think preparatory.
Preparatory.
Yeah. I'm not positive on that one, but that's my guess. So throughout the whole year, you have more intensive meditation than the rest of the community. You'll have additional. So you'll have one meditation with the community, and then you'll have another one without the community. And then you'll have more prayers as well that you're supposed to be following along. And then you'll have certain classes that are about your spirituality. And you're not graded on these classes. You're just studying spirituality. And you study the catechism, and you study morality, but it's all related to like a spiritual formation and a human formation in that sense as well. Both are very connected. And then after that, you enter into what we call intellectual studies or academics.
After that year.
Yeah. And then, so after that year, they had prepared the BA. So I was the second group that entered the BA at Newman, because it was sort of the philosophy that they had set up for the seminary, for my seminary track, was to do that. So I didn't really choose Newman. The Lord did in a lot of ways. I chose to go to St. Joseph's Seminary, and they chose to send me there. I chose to join the Diocese of Calgary. They sent me to St. Joseph's Seminary, and St. Joseph's Seminary sent me to Newman Theological College.
Newman and St. Joseph's are on the same campus.
Yes.
So you're living at St. Joseph's with a new cohort. You take the little walk over to Newman.
Yeah, it's about 99 steps.
99 steps, yes. Yeah. For the studies. Yeah. And so the first year of the studies, what did you discover? What did you make of it?
It was the first time I had ever been asked to do something that I knew that I wasn't going to be able to do, and they knew I wasn't going to be able to do it. And that was a really important part, I think. And that, I realized that very quickly when they asked us to read the Iliad in 2 weeks. for one class. That was for like a single class. And I was like, what? Like, wait, I can't read that book in 2 weeks. the language is weird. Like, it's poetry that's translated into English, though it's not even poetic anymore. Like, like there's some meter, but it's kind of gone. And so I started reading some of these great texts and trying to extract anything that I possibly could get from them. And it was a task that I knew I was not going to be able to complete. And I think my professors knew I was not going to be able to complete it as well. And so, like, within the first month, we were reading the Iliad, the Aeneid, Plato's Republic. We were reading a book on logic, about Socratic logic. So it wasn't they slid it in under the great books terminology, because right. Great books is, traditionally, you would read the primary sources themselves. This was a book that was sort of presenting the primary sources of Socratic logic. So it was kind of skirted the the criteria. But it rocked my world. It's nevertheless, it was still very good. And so those were some of the, and then we also started reading some church documents on music as well. So the same documents that my mom had read, and even some of the ones that predated the ones my mom had read. So
that would be in the course on beauty.
Yes, a course called Way of Beauty. Yes, yeah. And a big component of the course on Way of Beauty is studying church music. So you study it through singing, but also through just trying to breathe in the tradition, and the development, the real development that takes place organically, slowly, but still very real. In the way that the church does music in certain ways. So those were sort of some of the courses that I just was thrust into immediately. And I love them. I love them very much. Despite the fact that I was definitely like way in over my head. And I also had a course on Introduction to Scriptures was the other one. And so I was reading the church's tradition on the scripture documents as well. So all of the documents of the church on scriptures we read in that class.
Going back?
Yeah, like explicitly on scriptures. So if you say all of the church's documents on scriptures, you could include all of the church's documents.
Well, of course, but
but the I think we started with Trent. I do think we started with Trent. Mm. So documents explicitly on the like reading scriptures in the way that it ought to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And we walked through them, and so like encountering this tradition was just like a whole new thing that I was not expecting to have. And it continued throughout that whole first year where we like in one of our classes, we walked through sort of the main figures of philosophy throughout the last 3,000 years. Like the whole class, that was all it did. Right. We read their texts. And so I know the way they Aristotle sounds.
Yeah.
And I know the way Augustine sounds in his philosophic texts.
Yeah.
And all these different things. And I know how tricky it is to read Hegel.
Yeah.
And I can appreciate that.
Yeah.
In a way that I had no idea. I didn't even know who Hegel was, let alone the importance of studying him in the way that the nuance and the difficulty sometimes of finding those nuances. Because you're studying texts that were written in other languages and translated here and there. And sometimes the translation's phenomenal and sometimes the translation's less than optimal.
So was the task here, or did it unfold in a way that tried to help you appreciate what the author's up to? Read your way into the way in which Hegel, the way in which Aristotle, the way in which Augustine was working with ideas and the tradition, trying to think through things, as opposed to, I guess I would say, as opposed to reading a secondary source which would extrapolate from all these people particular things for whatever the person writing that secondary source was preoccupied
I had very good professors who were very, very careful to not denigrate the author.
Yeah.
Like, even if we were reading Karl Marx.
He's a significant thinker.
He's very significant. And if you don't see how his rhetoric is unbelievably provocative and attractive in a certain level, you're missing a lot of what he's saying.
Yeah.
And so I had a really good philosophy professor, like really, really good, who walked through all of these different texts. It's Dr. Francis Fast, unbelievable. And he's a Thomist by like discipline, but he was unbelievably fair.
Yeah.
To every single philosopher we encountered. There was nobody who he said, yeah, that guy's just, this is just, I like, we just got to get through this. I know that this is this doesn't make sense. He was like, no, like, do you understand how this is attractive?
Mm-hmm.
And then only after we found out what was attractive in everything, were we allowed to dissect and say, okay, I think that this is where it might go off a little bit. Right.
But that first step is you know, Alfred North Whitehead, Yaroslav Pelikan used to say that Alfred North Whitehead, he knew him when Whitehead was at Princeton University, used to say that Whitehead was the most intelligent human being that ever walked on American soil. You know, Whitehead was an Englishman and had done all of his work with Russell on mathematics.
Okay.
And then he had a son that was killed in the war. And he was, I think, 60 years old when he turned his mind to philosophy. And then he devoted the rest of his life to thinking about the world of great ideas. You've got him sitting right next to your elbow there on the top shelf. And Whitehead wrote a lovely book on the aims of education. And he says that the first aim of education is romance. You know, and that's what I hear you saying, and that's what I've seen at Newman when I was teaching there a little bit, just in talking with colleagues and then seeing what happens with students. You must fall in love with Aristotle, with Euripides, with the Aeneid, with Plotinus, with Augustine. And Whitehead goes on to say the second aim of education is, I can't remember the term he uses for it, but it's depth, you know, romance, then really get to know. And you need to get to know them in their own terms. In a way, this comes back to friendship, you know, that you spoke about earlier. And also this notion of wanting to walk with people, wanting to walk with the tradition, make friends with it. And so that period of depth, of course, takes a long time. And then Whitehead says, and there is then a third, but that's only for a few and much later on, and that's called analysis. I think it's, and that's what I saw happening at Newman with Francis and Ryan Topping and the others that were there. You know, the president, that there was a real feel for the wonder of these texts and for the fact that these are our ancestors.
Yeah.
It's not about whether you agree with them or disagree with them, whether you can argue with them or not. Let's get to know them first.
Yeah.
So, that's beautiful.
Yeah, no, it was a privilege that I wasn't expecting. And it was really, so I received a very, like that first year, I realized I was receiving a very high-end education, to my surprise. Like, I had no idea. Like, I didn't necessarily think I was going to get a bad education. I just didn't know that I was going to be something that had depth. And suddenly I started seeing streams of thought in my family and my friends and my society.
Yeah, you could see who they're lining up with.
Well, yeah, and I'd be like, oh man, like you have no idea, like, yeah. Like you're talking just like this guy.
That's right.
And I would say this to them, so I like started getting a little bit of a title, being like, oh, Andre's in love with philosophy, which is true. It was true. And I'd be like, yeah, you're just talking just like him, but you're losing the beauty of it. Like you're just taking his terrible, like the outskirts of his ideas and losing the heart.
You just mind it.
Yeah.
For some other purpose.
Yeah. And it would often not like, it would not be like using Aquinas. It would be like using Hegel and taking his progressivism without and leaving everything else. And it's like, well, why would you ever do that? And Hegel like can have his problems, but like he has some really interesting ideas. And without him, we wouldn't have this way of thinking about history that he has presented. I just started seeing all these different trends that started to really like have direct connections to these philosophers. But also like we had a beautiful course on Catholic studies where we read many of the Catholic texts as well, on like just in the Catholic tradition. So we read things like the Confessions of St. Augustine and the On the Incarnation by St. Athanasius and all these different things, the Jesuit relations for us in Canada, which was really special. And St. Therese's Story of a Soul. And we even read all the way up to some texts by Ratzinger on like the Regensburg Address, and things like that. So I started seeing some of these trends within the Christian tradition as well, right? So like all of a sudden I started understanding a little bit, like I had never heard the term deification ever in my life, ever. Even I went to a Benedictine, like I said, I went to a Benedictine monastery for 4 years, and it wasn't that they didn't know it. It just wasn't that terminology was used. Like I had heard the idea of being in communion and union with God, but I'd never heard of words that were used to describe that. Things like deification, theosis, divinization. But suddenly I had some language to almost speak of a tradition that I had been seeped in as well. So there was a double-sided sort of gift. There is the gift of being able to understand where some of these things were coming from and being able to talk about them and describe them.
Because ground had been established.
Yeah, exactly.
Ground had been established.
Suddenly I started seeing things a little bit and understanding a little bit more. And I hope it's grown a little bit from then. And so, that was really the first year for me at Newman. It was really quite special.
And then you're in the seminary. Another thing that has struck me about Newman, for the little piece that I was there, is it seemed to me a kind of intentional way of forming the education, the intellectual part that you've spoken about, and it's lovely to hear how this greeted you. You were thrown into it. You knew this was more than you could master. But friendship was emerging. You were becoming friendly with the tradition. So I love the book by Jean Leclerc, the great Benedictine scholar of the medieval period, who wrote a beautiful book on monastic culture called The Love of Learning and the Desire for God. So the other part of this that I thought I was seeing at Newman as well was the desire for God part, and that this was primarily embodied, to the extent that I saw it, in the cultivation of the liturgical life at Newman. And you're in the seminary, so that's going to be even a bit more intense than for the lay students at Newman. But I also saw that you and other seminaries would gather periodically with the lay students. You would pray the office together.
So that desire for God part of it stood out for me as well, and the way in which the kind of synergy between that and the love of learning.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I, of course, had never seen anything like that before.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had the first logic class I ever had, and this was the best way I think anyone could ever start a logic course. And I don't like to speak in hyperbole too much. The professor literally just said, and he turned to us, he said, "Listen, in my life, the only thing that I've ever done is search for truth. And I think that I found it in the Catholic tradition." He's a Catholic priest. "And I think that I found it in the person of Jesus Christ. The only thing that, if you take one thing away from this course and in your life, is to search for truth wherever it may be found."
In a logic course.
Yeah.
A logic course. The search for truth is the point of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to get that in many courses on logic.
It blew me. Like, when I sat, I just sat there and I was like, wow, that really... And, like, it harkens to a, like, a really old tradition. Augustine's comes to mind in On Christian Doctrine, where he says, wherever truth is to be found, Christ is its master. Where it recognizes, I'm taking a course on theology of revelation, but it recognizes revelation wherever it may be found. And so it's true, like, this search for God, it really was a personal thing for, I think, everybody in my class. But it was, like, with this understanding that God has revealed himself in many, many ways. And it was a hunger to try and discover those ways. And, like, a hunger to discover, like, so the term, like, a special revelation in our tradition, or older terms would say, like, a supernatural revelation. And the general revelation in tradition, with a lowercase t, and sometimes with a capital T. That all of that is revelation, and it's real, and it's to be taken seriously. And that this person that you want to know is speaking in a real way, yeah.
The unveiling of the mystery of the incarnation.
Yeah.
Which is everywhere present.
Yeah.
And fillest all things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it really was, you could tangibly feel it. One of the reasons why we were willing to get to know these authors is because we knew that they had something to say about the one that we loved. And that is truth himself. And so even if the craziest and, like, from the outskirts, right? So it's like the most abstract thought and the most odd and peculiar names. Still, they had something to say. It was tangible. And so there is a deep side of what we were doing that was also fed, by, like, a liturgical, like, again, like, it comes back to this liturgical sensibility of what are you doing while I'm preparing for the liturgy? And so I'm looking for God wherever he may be found, so that I can offer myself to him and then receive him as well. And so, like, that element, that really liturgical.
Did you see this among your fellows, your peers? Did you see how your particular experience of it, was that something that you sensed was going on for quite a number of them, if not all of them?
I do sense that. I think that for many of them, yes. I think to varying degrees and with different perspectives. Now I'm describing this program and the beauty of the program. There were difficulties, right? Sometimes it wasn't always as organized as it could be and all these different things. And sometimes for some, I would say those difficulties cast a shadow on the beauty. Because especially for the year that was ahead of me, they had more difficulties than we did because they were the guinea pigs.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And it was COVID.
So yeah. You didn't have as much as this sense of camaraderie in the classroom. You were kind of waiting to get out of the classroom so that you could go back to the seminary. Cause at the seminary we were our cohort. So it was like you basically could interact freely, but at the school at Newman, even though it was a class of seminarians, you still had to interact as if it was a sort of in a sterile environment, which it does affect a learning environment. When you have masks covering your face, it does. And that was very present there. And so some of them don't have as fond as memories, but they do have fond memories. All of them. That is unanimous.
Mm-hmm.
It astounds me how even some of the lesser academic seminarians who just kind of see academics as something they have to get through, and they're there more for the seminary than the academics, which is fine. Still manage to, like, this tradition managed to really permeate them.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear them talking and bringing up different authors, and you're mm-hmm. what an amazing thing that this person actually
has been touched.
Yeah. And is able to interact with this and remember this and understand mm-hmm. this. And so I have a really fond experience. I think that most seminarians have an overall very fond experience. But I think that the difficulties that I experienced were not the same difficulties that everybody else experienced.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
That's going to be particular.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It did change a lot of the things at the seminary as well, I would say. Like, not in big major ways, but I think that it changed. Previously, what seminary would do for philosophy, because that requirement for philosophy to be before theology has been installed for many, many, many years. I don't know the full history, but it's as long as I can think of seminaries. That sort of distinction between those two stages mm-hmm. in formation. Previously, they would send some seminarians to the U of A.
Right.
And some seminarians to Concordia based off of where the seminarian could get in.
Yeah.
Because not every seminarian had the grades to get into the U of A. And so they would often be able to get into Concordia because there was a little bit more of an interaction between Concordia and the seminary so that they could make amendments. So there is a disconnect between those groups.
Unsurprising.
Yeah. But also it was very difficult for those groups because they weren't as connected to the seminary.
Mm-hmm.
So the seminary had the theologians going to Newman Theological College 90 steps away. They had some seminarians going to the U of A, which could be up to a 20-minute drive in traffic, and some seminarians going to Concordia, which is closer but still far, like still not next door. And so suddenly you had very distinct cohorts within the seminary rather than one sort of united cohort. And so by having the BA in Newman, we've been able to now have all of our seminarians at the same college, which has added a dimension of community that I think is very, very necessary and very beneficial. And it's taken off a lot of stress towards my formators because planning class schedules around three different institutions and figuring out when we were going to have mass is a really big challenge.
So
the old schedule would have mass at different times almost every single weekday because they would piece it in wherever they could get it. And sometimes it would be early in the morning at like 6:30, and sometimes it would be like in the evening before supper. So you would have very different mass times based off of where all these different seminarians were going. So now we're a little bit more in-house and together, which I think is a huge benefit because, again, you get that brotherly experience where the theologians aren't those guys who study at a different college than you. They're your brothers who are ahead of you. Who can show you a little bit of the way, and they've read the same books you've read. And they can help you a little bit with your homework sometimes, which is that's a very big difference. It seems like a small thing, but it's actually very, very big in terms of community building. That common education is actually something that had a really big impact on the seminary, I would say.
Mm-hmm. And the seminarians in the BA program are also regularly interacting with students that aren't studying for priesthood. Mm-hmm. Some of them are young men, some of them are young women. Oh. So there's an interesting synergy there, mm-hmm. as well, which I would think would be helpful,
yeah.
for people studying for the priesthood as they move along that path to have had a sense of brotherhood, fellowship in their formation, both in the intellectual formation and also in the formation in their spiritual formation, mm-hmm. associated with the desire for God. To have had that level of intimacy in this formation as well. Is it fair of me to suggest that? I mean, it's one thing I've wondered about.
Yeah, I think that there were some seminarians who were initially actually quite concerned. And that showed me that it was a really good thing.
Mm. What were they concerned about?
They were concerned that they were going to fall in love.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And that it would somehow jeopardize their vocation. Mm-hmm. Which I think is legitimate to an extent, but realistically it's quite off point, actually. Because one, when you're in the seminary, you're not actually ordained a priest.
Of course, yeah.
But the other point is that in the Catholic Church, specifically the Roman Catholic Church, the people who are involved with you the most in ministry are women. Mm-hmm. And if you're afraid of women, then mm-hmm. there's a serious problem that you're going to have very quickly in your mm-hmm. ministry.
Yeah.
And so interacting with young women has actually been a huge area of formation for me. Because going to minor seminary, I actually never really had female friends ever. Mm-hmm. So figuring out and having the grace to learn how to be friends with mm-hmm. women. Mm-hmm. Very kind, very, very nice women who love the Lord very much.
And some of them very bright.
And some of them very bright. And, yeah, and some of them single, right? Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. like, and knowing and learning those boundaries as well, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one of the words that they love to use at the seminary. It's boundaries are not like walls.
Right.
They're more like the bank of a river.
Yeah.
Where they try and direct the flow somewhere yeah. where it's meant to go.
Yeah.
And so having proper boundaries in place and things like that, and having the relationships to actually discuss, like, how does this, like, I actually had enough good, healthy relationships with women at the seminary that I've been, or at Newman, that I've been able to discuss with them. Okay. These are the boundaries that I have in place. Are they enough? Mm-hmm. Because going forward, I'm going to need to know this. and like some of these, young women are now married and they have families, mm-hmm. which is very beautiful. And they're able to tell me I think that's good. Or sometimes they're like, yeah, I think that when you say certain things like this, sometimes women will interpret it this way.
Sure.
And so like teaching you in some ways how to talk to women, so which is actually really important for a priest as well.
Yeah.
Because half of your congregation will likely be women.
Probably more than half.
Yeah. So it's been a huge gift. And I think that it's pushed a lot of my brother seminarians in ways that they didn't necessarily want to be pushed yet, but in the ways that they really was good for them. And I think that it has been a beautiful thing to see. So even some of the most introverted seminarians developing good, healthy friendships, mm-hmm. brother and sister friendships with mm-hmm. some women mm-hmm. and then also men at the college as well. Yeah. And so yeah. where you can, you learn how to interact with people who are in your daily life. It's a very human thing to have to learn. but it's something that you still have to learn. Yeah.
Lovely.
Thank you for joining us. Andrée's fine mind and gracious spirit animated each class I was privileged to teach that he attended. Through this conversation, I've come to learn about his formation, his growth into the rhythms of a liturgical life. This began with his mother and father and continued in the Anglican Ordinariate in full communion with the Pope of Rome, and deepened at Christ the King Seminary with the Benedictine monks and praying the daily office. At Newman Theological College, and in the presence of grappling with the great books, as you have just heard him say, he experienced for the first time what he didn't know he knew. His discernment towards priesthood continues at St. Joseph's Seminary in Edmonton. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.